What do you get when you put words to music, add a little, okay, maybe a lot of drama, and dress it up in bright lights and fancy costumes? Today on the Asymptote Podcast, translating opera. I'm Dominic Boyle, and I'm happy to say that I'm joining the Asymptote team as a podcast editor working along with Layla. By the way, if you haven't heard already, Asymptote is standing strong against Trump's Muslim ban and the anti-immigrant sentiment it represents. For our spring edition, the team is putting together new art and writing from seven majority Muslim nations banned in Trump's executive order on immigration. Help us make this possible by donating to our Indiegogo campaign and stand with us. Of course, there are great perks for donating, but maybe the best perk is that 20% of what we raise will go directly to the ACLU and Refugees Welcome, so you'll be supporting us and two other amazing nonprofits at the same time. With 4 days to our campaign left, there's no time to waste, so check it out today by going to asymptote.org and following the link at the bottom of the page. Now, the reputation of opera today is that it's maybe a little bit removed from popular culture.
Grand opera in a grand place, in old-fashioned language with surtitles.
A bit aristocratic. But it wasn't always the case. That's Amanda Holden, by the way, and she's an opera librettist and translator. Surtitles, those are the things she hates. Text which runs above the opera as it's being performed in real time. We'll hear more from her later. So, anyways,
while it is true that opera was born thanks to aristocratic circles, it became very popular. And until the 1920s in Europe, it was a very, very, very popular form of entertainment. In Italy, it was massively popular. And by popular, I really mean people from all classes going to attend it. I mean, people like Caruso sang to massive audiences.
And with that popularity came the desire to make it accessible to more audiences. And so along came the translators.
It has changed, but I think that it was for a long while, well, at least a century and a half or something, very, very popular.
This is Lucille de Blache. She's a professor at the University of Roehampton in London, whose work bridges translation and music. She's also the founder of Translating Music, a long-term project looking at how translation and music are combined.
I work in translation studies, but my initial background is in music. And I seem to sort of happily go with the two parallel roads for a long while and gradually sort of join them together.
I talked with her to find out more about the history of opera. So how did it come about?
It depends how far back you want to go. You could say in a way that Greek theater was a form of opera because it involved staging and singing, but it wasn't called opera. Actually, it wasn't called opera for a very long time. The word opera appeared in 1659. But what happened is in the Renaissance, people started to put the idea of having plays that would be sung drama. But really, opera as we know it was born in Tuscany. It was very much something that aristocrats put together. It was at a time when there was a fashion for pastoral drama. And they had the idea, it was primarily in Florence that the idea emerged. They had the idea of having this pastoral drama, but with singing. And that was also part of the Renaissance generally, not just about music, rediscovering the antiquity. So the person who claimed the style of opera was somebody called Emilio Cavalieri, and he staged an oratorio. So some people don't think it's the first opera because it was a religious topic. It was called The Representation of Soul and Body, and that was in 1600. But he claimed that he started to put together all the different forms the recitative style, where people sing in the style of speaking, arias, ensembles, and choruses.
So this Emilio Cavalieri started to assemble the main musical ingredients of opera. The recitative, where characters half sing and half speak.
The recitatives basically say, I'm coming, I'm going, I'm fighting, I'm going to do this, I've done that.
Great for getting through plot quickly. Ensembles, where two or more characters sing together. Choruses, where everyone sings because this part is really dramatic. And the crown jewel of opera, the invention that really set it apart, the arias.
And the arias actually are a moment of standing still and considering a situation kind of psychologically and emotionally.
And this form, one voice floating over a bed of instruments, expressing the inner psychological workings of these very human characters that we see on stage, is what sets opera apart. It's called
monody. This was what the revolution was. The revolution was monody, alternating this recitative style of sung, spoken text, and arias and ensembles, which had little text.
Okay, so the ingredients were assembled by Cavalieri, but one of the defining parts of opera is that it's a secular story.
It's absolutely a secular story, and it's also in that respect that it's a typical product of Renaissance humanism. It's sort of secular, it aims to mirror and revive Greek sung theater, and also it was based on these pastoral plays. And it was very much something that the nobility liked because they saw themselves as Jupiter or as Mercury, you know. And the first operas tended to represent the people that commissioned the opera.
And the fact that opera is telling secular stories combined with the stylistic innovations of monody is really what makes opera such a smash hit. Audiences loved the drama and they loved seeing their lives reflected before them on the stage.
Now, the first person who produced what we know now as a masterpiece is, of course, Monteverdi with his Orfeo. So yet again, the topic wasn't original for the time because they were all doing it, sort of Eurydice and all this. He called it Favola in Musica, so a fable in music, and that was in 1607. And this is, you know, when we consider the first opera to be fully born.
So now that opera is fully born, what happens to it?
Initially, it wasn't translated so much because it was in this aristocratic circle.
But the aristocrats can't keep it to themselves for too long.
What is interesting is that quite soon, opera became popular as a public performance. So initially, it was aristocrats that did it for themselves and their friends. But in particularly in Venice, it started to become popular with the people. And this is when they started to build theaters, operatic theaters. And they were performing mostly in the vernacular. So there were many, many operas adapted into Venetian dialects and whatever. So translation happened pretty quickly on. And I think it depended, really. I think that the higher culture, the performance, the more it tended to be performed in Italian, in Tuscan Italian. And Tuscan became the main language of Italy. But it wasn't in those days. Italy was centralized very late. And you could say, in a way, that opera contributed to establish Tuscan as the sort of high cultural language, if you like.
So, as the popularity of opera in Italy grows, aristocrats in other European courts caught word. They hired their own Italian poets and had their own court composers produce opera reflecting them as well.
So, for example, in Vienna, you had somebody like Lorenzo da Ponte, the man who wrote Mozart, as he is known. And although they were at the court of Joseph II in Vienna, they wrote them in Italian, and they were Italian.
But this Italian-only approach to opera didn't stick around long either.
So as it became popular and it sort of started to go across frontiers, it was translated into languages from the middle of the 17th century. Especially in Germany, it became popular in translation quite quickly.
Why? Because opera is supposed to move the audience, and in order for them to be moved, they need to understand it. Translation is what allowed opera to move beyond the palace walls. And as soon as opera became something for the common people, opera in translation quickly became the norm.
So immediately you had these two forms. You had the singing translation, and you had translated libretto that people looked at.
Until modern technology allowed for the easy projection of translations above a stage, or surtitles as they're known, opera was usually sung in translation. Amanda Holden, who we've already heard a bit from, is a modern-day opera translator who specializes in creating singing translations. She thinks that opera doesn't always have to be heard in its original language, especially if that means bringing surtitles into the mix.
There is a group of people, this is something completely different, who actually think that opera ought to be done in its original language, and they are so boring.
Why do you think they're boring?
Because they are, well, they're blinkered. Well, perhaps they just have only been to opera, in a grand opera in a grand place, in old-fashioned language with surtitles, and perhaps they just haven't really experienced it. It may be as simple as that.
For Amanda, opera in translation isn't really anything to write home about. It's just how it always was.
So I did grow up in London. I heard a lot of opera in English, and it seemed completely normal. And then when I was a student, I went to live in Munich, and everything was performed in German. And that was the policy of most opera houses, I think. It was also in accordance with what the composers wanted. So Puccini, when he came to London to hear Tosca, heard it in English. And I don't think a lot of people know that.
So then when you're beginning your own translation, how do you approach it? What's your process?
Ah. Well, the first thing to do is listen to the piece and get it kind of downloaded on your old personal hard disk, I think. And I think one thing that's very important for opera translators is that you're writing words to be sung and to be heard, not to be read, because it's all written by the composer as something to hear. So I listen a lot and try and get to know these people. And you get to know the story and the words, because the aim of a translation is to get as close as possible to the original, while producing something that is totally easily understandable in another language, i.e. it's impossible.
The immediacy that a sung translation can provide is for Amanda its greatest virtue. It means that
the closest possible is something that this audience, this today's audience, will understand very, very easily. I just feel they should be very, very easily assimilated, because what the composer wants is to listen to the music. I just think that the music is actually fleshing out the words, which actually should be as few as possible, I feel.
So what's it like when you're translating then, having to fit these words into a system which has been prearranged by the composer already?
Right. That's the other thing you have to do after you have got to know with it and you're sitting down with your pencil and paper and thinking, how on earth am I do this? It's to do with shape, hearing it in your head, thinking of something that will work, something that singers can sing. I mean, I think singers are actually amazing these days. They'll sing anything. But it has to sound natural. I mean, I've been actually looking at some songs today and reminding myself of actually how hard it is, because all the poetry is in the wrong order. You know, all the verbs and nouns are in the wrong place for English. So you really have to think of something that will fit and make sense and say the same thing as what the poem says. There you go. Doddle.
Right. Because then it's not just about the order of the words, it's also where the emphasis of the music falls.
Absolutely. And that is different in every language. It's possibly easiest in German, a bit harder in Italian, and pretty impossible in French, quite easy in Russian. And it does help if you're a linguist, but you don't have to be one. And I've been the subject of huge teasing and so on, because I start talking in 18th century German in a German class. You know, just sorry, people think I'm completely mad. And I'm talking sort of in Mozartian magic flute German, you know. And I can say, well, I can order a pizza, but translating Monteverdian Italian isn't the same thing. It's a whole different mindset. And I can hear it, I can translate it, but I wouldn't want to write it or speak it, because I've learnt languages through these strange opera librettos, these mad things. So it's always been a bit of a struggle.
Do you think that different languages bring about differences in the music?
Oh, yeah. And I think that in an ideal world brings a flavour. Now, this is something that sounds a bit highfalutin, but I would really like to think that my Carmen translation doesn't sound exactly the same as my Marriage of Figaro translation.
Lucille also agrees that the language and the linguistic context surrounding an original opera does affect any translations that are made of it. Different countries developed different styles of opera, for example, which require different approaches to translation.
Yes, it very much affects the music. First of all, we were talking about different types of opera. So if we go back to sort of the heyday of opera, you would have had opera seria, which was all sung. There was no spoken text at all. And then you would have had a more popular opera in Germany or in German-speaking country. It was the Singspiele, for example. The magic flute is a survivor of that. And to this day, you can have performances of the magic flute with the text sung in German, but spoken in the language of the country. It's still not uncommon to have that. So that's very much affecting the translation, how the music is structured, or if bits of it do not have sung text.
In the Wild West of 18th and 19th century opera translation, they went even further, often with the consent or even participation of the original composer.
They didn't just change the text, they changed the style. So, for example, there was a battle between French and Italian style in the days of Gluck. It was interesting that Gluck wrote two very different, well, quite different operas to suit the styles, the French styles, which was quite different from the Italianate style. And he, actually, there are two versions of the opera that are different, not just to accommodate the odd beat, to match the, but to accommodate the taste of the people.
And not just little differences.
There could be huge differences. There could be whole passages removed. There could be bits added. There could be arias included. You know, copyrights wasn't what it is now. And they could more or less do whatever they wanted to do what they thought would please the public.
So this music, which goes to a ballet, and is very popular in the Paris version, in the original, not to be found. All in all, there are three distinct versions, with librettos in two languages. What's more, because the music in opera comes first, you could say that the very sound of the language being sung is an important part to the opera. And this would, of course, change based on the language.
Well, I think that different languages required or inspire different music. So, for instance, in French, we don't have any tonic accent, any accentuation in words. So, you know, you would in English say development, and the stress is in ve, development. So if you were singing development, you would have your first beat on the V. But this is not the case in French. It's a monotonous language. There is no stress. So you would have to structure your musical rhythm differently.
And actually, this is a strong argument against a reliance on sung translations. If opera is about the music, and music is about sound, then isn't the sound of the language important as well? Which is why, in the 1980s, when a new translation technology emerged, it was readily adopted.
Surtitling, really, rather than subtitling, surtitling, which emerged in the 1980s, changed the landscape because it didn't become that necessary to sing in a translated language. You could enjoy the language of the original language and still understand the words.
Surtitling, or sometimes called supertitling, was a breakthrough. Not only could the opera be sung in its original language, but everyone could understand everything by reading along. In multilingual countries, you no longer had to pick one translation to sing. You could project two languages or more simultaneously. In recent years, theaters have even begun adopting seatback displays, so each person can decide their own language.
So, surtitling is about clarity and concision.
In an ideal world, they should melt away into the background.
Judy Palmer, who was the head of surtitling at the Royal Opera House, and that was very much involved in the Translating Music project, always said that the perfect way was to be invisible. She said that she would be successful if people didn't remember which language they actually heard the opera in.
But that concision also comes at a price. Amanda says that instead of helping, surtitles actually get in the way. They're clunky, just not natural.
And they have to fit into the right number of syllables on a line, the right number of, you know, of letters on a line. And therefore, they completely betray the poor librettist who might have been trying to do something quite poetic. Yeah, I hate them.
Well, surtitles do make the original language accessible.
It's to do with a direct communication. You're not going to understand an opera in the same way as if it's in your own language.
So instead of listening and watching the action on stage,
you're trying to follow surtitles. I mean, you might as well go home and go to bed, you know, because you can't follow it. For the person who does the surtitles, I mean, what a bum job. To try and follow a singer, you know, because singers ought to have a little bit of leeway and a little bit of spontaneity, I think.
And for Amanda, that's what it comes down to. Opera needs to communicate directly with its audience, no matter what language it's in.
I mean, why not just talk to somebody? You know, that's really what opera is doing. It is talking, telling you a story.
I think that also surtitling is having an effect.
The result of it has been that people listen even less, and that singers actually project even less because they know people aren't listening. I mean, it's a vicious circle.
Beyond that, Lucille thinks that surtitling is changing opera musically as well.
Yes, because people know that, you know, that surtitling is pretty universal now in all opera houses. And people know that people can understand the text. I remember going to hear an opera and it was all on the high register of voices. And I couldn't understand anything. So now people know that they will get a sense of narrative.
But opera is also changing in other ways, morphing just as it always has, being shaped by the language and the culture which produces it, and always trying to stay relevant to modern audiences.
I think opera is evolving. Opera is still associated with a sort of high culture now, as it is. But it's trying, I think, to bridge other forms that are more popular. Because I think we live in an era where contact with audiences is vital.
And I'm glad now that opera's been let off the leash and it's now very diverse and all sorts of odd things happen all the time.
Contemporary opera today is a wide and rich field, with new works being written on topics high and low culture. Contemporary retellings of Orfeo and Eurydice, right alongside opera on Anna Nicole Smith.
Well, I think that we have the idea that opera is in such a way, but for all its history, it's like the rest of human history, you know, it's sort of organized chaos as it goes along.
Hey, thanks for listening. Just one more reminder. Stand with Asymptote against Trump's Muslim ban. Head to our Indiegogo campaign and donate to support our showcase of new art and writing from the seven banned nations. Plus, 20% of what we raise will go directly to the ACLU and Refugees Welcome, so it's really a no-brainer. With 4 days left to go, there's not a lot of time, so check it out today by going to asymptote.org and following the link at the bottom of the page.